you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This is the TechNet. This is TechNet number 1577 of the series that began September of 1982, 33 years ago. We're all kind of amazed that it has lasted this long. We think it's the longest running net under one group of leadership in the history of ham radio nets. We believe that's true. The total number of hours that TechNet has been on the air is greater than the total number of hours that Johnny Carson was on The Tonight Show over his 30-year period of time. So there's lots of information that has been gathered by this group of enthusiastic and inquisitive and curious people that meet each Sunday night for the last 33 years. The main common denominator is that we'd all like to know how to make radio equipment work better. The scientists in us, I think inside of every good ham radio operator, there's a scientist trying to get out, a curious scientist that wants to know how things work, and knowledge is power. We'd like to have a little more knowledge about what is Mother Nature really telling us about these radio waves. A man who teaches physics, Steve, K-A-2-Y-H-Y, and I have had a serious number of discussions on how a dipole really works at the atomic level. What really goes on when that E and H wave hits that dipole? What's the phasing of that current and voltage and whatever? After all these years of working on so many antennas, I'm still discovering, along with you guys, I'm discovering how the most basic of all antennas, how a dipole really works. Let me drop it. So once again, it's more of a proof that there's more knowledge, that there's more things unknown than known at any point in time. And if you want to know more about it, you got to meet the right friends, you got to talk to the right people, and exchange ideas. That's what ham radio operators do in the 26 different kinds of ham radio. We put a transmitter, a receiver, an antenna, a feed line, we put it all together, and to prove that it's working, we talk to our fellow amateur radio operators. The first thing that you tell each other is, what is my handle, where do I live, and what equipment are you using? What equipment did you used to use? Which worked better? How did you make improvements? What changes are you making? What do you intend to do next in order to make it more effective, less offensive to the neighborhood, to the wife, give you more performance, and so on? Ham radio is an extremely educational hobby, because there's some real high power brain gray matter out there on the other end of those Morse code keys and the other end of those microphones. And the FCC has given you this fantastic, what's the word for it now? Gift is the best way to put it. Your taxi cab company that's campaigning for a frequency pair so that they can talk to their taxi cabs or dispatch their oil trucks or whatever. They go on a great big waiting list to get one set of frequencies, and they pay for it heavily. We ham radio operators are given tremendous numbers of megacycles, every single octave, literally from DC to light, free of charge. Let me drop. That's one hell of a resource that we're handed. And why in the world would they do that? Because the evidence is that we make very good use of it. The people who really understand antennas are basically ham radio operators tinkering in the backyard. The guys who really understand oscillators and transmitters and feed lines are those ham radio operators. When it comes to times of stress to humanity, whenever there's emergencies, the hams are there. So we're given these frequencies, tremendous numbers of them, every octave of the band, and we hold on to them. And as I said, that's an extremely valuable resource. Nobody else has that. On top of that, we're given the authority to use them. You're allowed to open up that transmitter and make any change you like, as long as you're reasonably assured you're not going to be transmitting on somebody else's frequency. Every piece of equipment that you touch, that you build, that you modify, is automatically type accepted. A taxi cab company has to go through a bunch of rigmarole making sure that he is using type accepted FCC approved equipment for running his taxi cab. We don't have to do that. They assume that we're going to do that correctly. As I said, it's one hell of a resource. And so we really enjoy it. Let me drop. I never even knew I was going to talk about that tonight. What does the TechNet really do? For the first hour, we take people's sign-ins because they do have a question or a comment for the net. After 33 years, we don't need a long list of people signing in saying, hey, I'm here. We believe that. After 33 years, after many thousands of hours of TechNet, it doesn't have to be proven anymore. And for those who are not able to stay up for the whole 4 hours that this thing lasts, 8 o'clock to midnight every night for the last zillion years, you can go to the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And there, the past 9 and a fraction years of TechNet are all recorded. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can, in 1 year, in 1 hour reels, you can play it all back. There are people who can't stay up as late as they'd like to hear the end of the TechNet. And a few days later, KC2NJI puts the information on the website, and therefore you can download it to whatever recording equipment you've got and play it back at your leisure as you're driving to work, while you're on the train, at your noon hour, and so on. So if you really want to hear information and you can't stay up that late, there's a way of doing that. Let me drop it. Yeah, mic number one and mic number two have these beautiful websites that support the TechNet. Mic number one is KC. I keep forgetting his call letters. KC2NJI. And mic number two has a website that is under the address of LimarkTechNet.com. And in both of those websites, you'll see articles, pictures, other pieces of information. Smith charts, how standing wave ratio works, how does a directional coupler work. Directional couplers are an extremely effective, completely passive piece of electronics that's very poorly covered, in my opinion, in all these schools that we use. We think it's a piece of magic equipment. You'd be amazed how easy it is for you to homebrew with a dollar's worth of stuff. You can make a directional coupler for any frequency you want once you understand the principle of operation. And there's an article there by K2RIW. Tells you quite a bit how to do that. It tells you how to use a directional coupler for making power and standing wave ratio measurements. But the back of that article tells you how to start off with a directional coupler that's on the wrong frequency and make it work at your frequency, and basically how to build one. You'd be amazed how simple it is. Let me drop it. As I was starting to say, the first hour we take people who sign in because they do have a question or a comment. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who does a pretty darn good job of collecting the mailbag. In other words, when people don't yet have the ham license, don't yet have the right equipment, so they can talk to us directly. By all kinds of means, they send things to John, KC2WGB. John chooses two, three, four of those that we think have general interest, and we discuss them. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, is our space expert. And he'll tell you what's the latest that's going on with National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the European Space Agency, and so on, what Japan is doing. How many of us know that Japan has a space station up there? A smaller version, so to speak, of our International Space Station. Our media gives very poor coverage of that. A little bit unfair to them, I think. And if there's any time left over, we go into other subjects. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment by giving us his call letters, his name, and the word yes, meaning that he does have a question for a comment. A sign-in might sound like this, WA2PJF. Vito, and yes, Vito is a guy who's lucky enough to have his brand new grid tip meter, which maybe we're going to hear a little bit about tonight. And that's a piece of instrumentation that Hal has been telling us about for a long time. That strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier that I designed way back in the dark ages of 1972. Major portions of that was designed with a grid tip oscillator, a grid tip meter. Very simple piece of test equipment. But boy, in the right hands, it can do an awful lot of magic. Okay, at this time, if you've got a question or comment, you're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes. Try to remember to give me your name, and also try to get a little bit a gap in between.
Repeater, timeout.
See, that's what you're not supposed to do. Give enough gap in between so the machine gets a chance to reset. Let me make sure we got the... Yeah, Eastman is still there. Enough gap to make sure the machine gets reset for all four beeps so that we don't time it out like I just did. Give me your call letters name right now. K2RIW in the tech net. Okay, I might have heard somebody sign in, but I only heard a couple of syllables. If a person does have a question or comment, give me your call letters and name right now. If you don't do that, John and I and Paul, we're just going to walk away. Somebody's got to sign with some real questions and comments. And by the way, I should mention, on the TechNet, we have a slightly different attitude from other organizations like ours. That is, there is no such thing as a dumb question. The so-called dumb question really means that what the person knows and what he would like to know, there's a great big gap in there. And therefore, his question is the one most deserving of an answer. There is no such thing as a dumb question. It's part of our philosophy. We also try not to offend people. We also don't absolutely positively guarantee that everything you're going to hear is 100% accurate all the time. But this is kind of peer-reviewed material. Since every bit of it is recorded forever, and various people are reviewing it all the time, when we make mistakes, we make some amount of mistakes every single TechNet. I sometimes listen to some of the past TechNets, and I realize the spoonerisms I say and mispronunciations and so on. We do make mistakes, but we make a sincere effort to correct them when they're brought to our attention. So give me a call, that is a name, right now if you've got a question or a comment, even a silly question. K2RIW, listening.
Net with a question.
Okay, I heard the word net with question. Squeeze the microphone, wait a couple of seconds, and then please repeat your call letters and name, sir. K2RIW. Unfortunately, that last transmission was 85% noise and 15% audio. Did anybody copy those call letters and or name? Please give me what you heard. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, the person trying to sign in, please give it another try. K2RIW listening.
K2RIW, and my name is Ed.
Okay, that time we heard my name is Ed, so we know it's Ed. But give us a nice one. Give us your call letters and name a number of times. It looks like by whatever means you're coming through, there's some kind of a delay before we start hearing your audio. Ed, try again. K2RIW, and give it to us a couple of times. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And also get a little closer to the mic.
K2DTY, King David 2, Charlie Tango Yellow.
Very fine, Ed. Glad that you gave it to us two or three times in a row. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Tango Yellow. Yankee. We got you, Ed. All right, the next person to sign in, please give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, my name is Dick, and we're listening.
Go, Kilo 4, Echo, Quebec Echo, First Personal Michael, and yes.
Good evening, Dick, K8YHY. No question, just checking in with you.
And good evening, Dick, Kilo 2, Juliet, Alpha, Sierra, Roger, yes, I have a question.
Best to end, Paul with the space report. Good evening, John, good evening, Dick, and everybody else on the net.
Okay, we finally woke up the guys. We got Michael, Echo, Quebec Echo, Steve, YHY, he's the guy who I told you about earlier, that we've been having discussions, sometimes very deep discussions about what is the moon doing to move out 1.5 inches per year, and how does a dipole really work at the atomic level? Okay, Roger, JAS. Alrighty, we got a good crew. One last call, just in case there's somebody out there trying to sign in. Give me your call letters and name right now.
Please copy November 4, Romeo, Quebec, Zulu. My name is Eddie, and I'm located out here in Virginia, and I'm just sitting here listening. And I am going through Echo Link, of course. And that's all I have to say.
Very fine. Eddie from Virginia. Romeo, Quebec, Zulu. Sound good. Glad to hear from you. Alrighty. Ed was the first guy who signed in. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Tango Yankee. And so, by whatever means you're signing in, Ed, there's about a 3 or 4 second delay before we start hearing your audio. So know that your first few words might have to be repeated. Go right ahead with your question, Ed. KD2CTY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
And I have a question about antenna splitters. What is the difference between a 15-ohm splitter and a 75-ohm splitter? Or is there a difference?
Yeah, when it comes to so-called splitters, power dividers, they usually use, say, for instance, to feed a pair of antennas. If I've got a single Yagi on the mast on top of the tower, and I want to double my gain, I want to double my effective capture area, I want to increase my range, I want to increase how loud the signal sounds, I stack another Yagi at the right distance above the first one, and now you need a power divider. Your main transmission line, which might be 50 ohms going up there, goes into the power divider, and if you're real smart, you've got equal length of cable from the power divider to the two separate Yagis, and you make double darn sure that one of the Yagis is not mounted upside down. When the guy puts two Yagis, one above the other, he's putting the power divider halfway between the two, and he likes to make a symmetrical system. Quite often the guy will take the bottom Yagi right side up and the upper Yagi right upside down. He doesn't realize he's creating 180 degrees of phase shift, and therefore the two signals don't add on the horizon like you'd like. You've now created a null on the horizon, and the real peak of the beam is now going to be, let me pick a number, 30 degrees above the horizon and 30 degrees below the horizon. So you got to be very careful. The power divider itself is a coaxial structure in most cases, although there's a waveguide equivalent of it. Let me drop. It's usually a coaxial structure. There's two or three different ways of making power dividers. Most of them are lossless, although there's ways of doing it with resistors, where you have 6 dB of insertion loss. But there's an advantage in that, by the way, for very broadband techniques like you might be using with a spectrum analyzer or a vector network analyzer. But it's usually a coaxial structure. And by the way you configure the center conductor diameter versus outer conductor diameter of the coaxial structure, meaning the feed line going into the power divider and all of the circuitry inside of the power divider, you can easily design one for 30 ohms, 50 ohms, 70 ohms, 100 ohms. And so if I was using 100 ohm antennas, I might want to use a power divider that's set up for 100 ohms. A ridiculous situation, but it's possible. If you make the mistake of using a 70 ohm power divider in a 50 ohm system, what have you done? That signal coming down the transmission line sees the beginning of that power divider, that's a 70 ohm structure. It thinks it's looking at a 70 ohm load. Therefore, it's going to think there's a 1.3. You take 70 divided by 50, that's the magnitude of your standing wave ratio. It's something like 1.3 to 1. But 1.3 to 1, don't lose any sleep over that. It makes an extremely minor perturbation. In most cases, let me drop. In most cases, until you hit a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, you should not be alarmed when it comes to the way the real signal flows and the way efficiency happens. If you create a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, if you had a 100-ohm power divider on your 50-ohm, at the end of your 50-ohm transmission line, yes, you would be making what looks like a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio before we get into the fine details. And even at a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in the worst case, you lose half a dB of potential power to transmit or potential receiver sensitivity, half a dB. That's 1/6 of an S unit of a low-calibrated S meter. There are lots and lots of guys thinking that if you don't have 1-to-1, or better than 1.1-to-1, that all hell's going to break loose. That Earth energy is nowhere near that persnickety of this particular factor. The only rub to what I'm just saying, let me drop it, is that in the old days of, say, for instance, a Heathkit TX100, or a Collins transmitter, which really had a pi output network. It really had a tuning and loading control, in which case you could take almost any phase angle of a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, inductive, capacitive, high ohms, low ohms, that would take at least a 3-to-1, and you adjust the tuning and loading control and the transmitter would make everything come out just right. All of a sudden, we decided that we wanted no tune transmitters. We wanted these compact rigs, no tune. And the manufacturers supplied what they think we wanted. The good news is the rig is now smaller, lighter, faster, and no tune required when you do band switching. But now, all of a sudden, there's a huge burden on you to make an extremely good match to that transmitter. The way the transmitters are frequently set up on 80 for 10 meters, if you exceed about a 1.5 standing wave ratio, which, by the way, would give you a couple of tenths of dB of loss, very little loss, a 2% loss, but a 1.5 standing wave ratio, and the transmitter goes into a self-protect mode, either turns itself off or turns itself down to a lower power. A no-tune transmitter on HF bands will do that. Your 2-meter rig and your 440 rig is a hell of a lot more forgiving. Let me drop it. Your 2-meter rig and your 440 rig, you can probably put it into a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. You know, it'll keep right on cranking. But these no-tune HF rigs of the 100-watt category, they're very persnickety. You got to have an extremely good match. So they've taken away the Pi network that used to be there. The rig has become more compact. But now, unless you've done an extremely good job of designing that antenna that you connect to it, you have to have an antenna tuner after it. So really, we're right back in the same ballpark, if you know what I mean. And now that antenna tuner will do the correction so that the rig sees better than a 1.5 standing wave ratio. So don't lose a lot of sleep over a 70-ohm power divider versus a 50-ohm power divider. And if you really fell in love with that 70-ohm power divider, and if you wanted the last couple of tenths of dB of performance, because you're doing state-of-the-art moon bounce, you're using an antenna that's nowhere near big enough to really do reliable moon bounce, and you're listening to super weak signals, and you wanted to use a 70-ohm power divider in a 50-ohm system, there's a way where you can put the right piece of coaxial cable into each one of the three ports of that power divider and make everything come out right. This way you can tune it, if you know what I mean. But since power dividers usually are not very expensive, you can homebrew or buy another one that's 50 ohms if you want it to be right. But don't let that stop you. Plug the 70 ohm in, use it for a while, and know that at some later time you can get a couple of tenths of a dB of improvement, a very fine improvement, if you need that last little bit of performance. That's some of the story. Over to you, Ed. KD2CTY. Let's see, I'm going to call you the microwave voice of New York City. Yeah, Park Avenue. Wow. A Park Avenue address. Very well done, Ed. You've got it, Ed. K2LIW. And you'll have to follow this up with more questions if you like. You've got it, Ed. K2LIW. My name is Dick.
CTY and
Gather,
that's the question. To share an antenna with two radios, but I think it would matter that much between the 50 ohm and the 75 ohm, according to what you're saying. And thank you for the answer. This is KD2CTY.
Yeah, I think that was Eric. And since I now found out that using the power divider to two separate radios, there's a number of other factors we should discuss. But let me pick up Eric first, who I think was Eric. KE2EJ, question mark, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Correct me if I'm wrong, but when I heard the original question, you wanted to know what the 75-ohm splitter, used the word specifically, which is as you know, a splitter, which is a device that either takes your antenna and turns it into two outputs that is reading 7 dB. It's actually a series of broadband networks. Do that. Looks a little bit like a Wilkinson device, but it's a different animal. And I just want to make that clear. If that was your question, but you're thinking of using a splitter for two radios, he's in for a little puff of smoke. Sorry, WK2J.
Yeah, it sounds to me, Eric, like you're doing a more complete job of listening to the questioner than I did. Yes, that so-called splitter is quite often used with television sets, where I guess in the old days it was combining a VHF antenna and a UHF antenna. The splitter took those two inputs, followed them with one piece of transmission line, and the modern day television set, the VHF and UHF all comes in on the same connector. So I think that's the splitter that you believe that the questioner was talking about. Let me turn it back to you, Eric, on that one, because the VHF-UHF people very frequently use what we call splitter. It really is a power divider, quite often to feed more than one antenna. So the exact same words are used in a very different context. KE2EJ for some more info. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, K2RIW, KE2EJ. Unfortunately, you think volts, not millivolts. You know, power dividers and what we call splitters, or CATV splitters, which you know, that little box usually had one input for VHF, one input for UHF. We don't do that anymore. You get splitters today to go from about 20 megahertz, or actually even lower for some of the cable applications, because the data is down there, all the way up to a gig and a half. So, we're talking low voltage, no power, receive levels, you know, 0 dBmV, if you want an actual value, plus 10 dBmV is a millivolt. So that's very common, and you'll find them everywhere, and it works great for two receivers off a single antenna. They could be on totally different bands because they're so wide bandwidth, but you pay for the loss, so there you go. Sorry, WK2J.
Yes? Give us a couple more words on this, Eric. In the old days, a VHF antenna and a UHF antenna were two separate structures, and you used a splitter to combine them down to one transmission line going into the television set. Nowadays, people are using splitters in order to combine, I guess, cable TV with maybe an over-the-air antenna.
Stop thinking that you're adding stuff together. Try thinking that sending it to two sets or three sets.
Okay, so you've got one good source, which might be cable TV, it might be Fios fiber cable into an adapter that gives you a coaxial output at 70 ohms, or over-the-air antenna, and now you're feeding multiple pieces of electronics, an FM tuner, and multiple receivers scattered around the house. And in that case, because of the loss of that kind of a splitter slash power divider, I guess a smart guy, if possible, would use a preamplifier in front of it so he can overcome that loss without losing sensitivity of those individual receivers.
You're too fancy. If you've got plus 10 coming in and you lose 3 dB, you're still going to overload the front end of your TV set.
If it's a cable TV system running 0 dBm input, absolutely. What happens if it's an over-the-air antenna? I know it's rare, but there's at least three people on this TechNet who use over-the-air broadcast television reception.
By the way, I've got some interesting information about preamp.
We're ready for that preamp information. Go right ahead, Eric.
I always wondered why I would stick a preamp in on some stations. It would get worse rather than better. Went through a whole series of different CATV and antenna amplifiers, and found as a general rule, okay, even if you're just trying to overcome, say, the loss of the cable, you get 75 feet cable, channel 13, let's use a higher frequency, channel 21, you got 3 or 4 dB loss, let's say. Okay, if you want to set your preamp to overcome that loss, be happy, you know, essentially replicate the amount of signal that's coming out of the end of the antenna. We've got an MER, or a TBM, whatever number you choose to use. You can play that to signal I, that gives you the SNR number, which is a little bit different. A really good rocking SNR for digital TV. It'd be about 35 dB, okay? The average number will really be around 30 if you measure the various stations. But I stick just about everybody's preamp. Some are better than others. That wonderful 35 will get as low as 27. Mid error rate starts to climb radically. It's an interesting phenomenon because you're adding noise. Try WK2J.
It's a lot of individual factors here to be considered. If this is the best of all possible worlds, you've got a fairly good antenna in a good location, but it's driving a very long piece of cable, and it's then going to be driving a power divider, a splitter, and four different pieces of electronics. To put a preamplifier, a so-called line-driving preamplifier, at the antenna and you're feeding the voltage up the coax cable in order to run it. In theory, that gives you the best of all worlds. You're driving the cable before you develop the loss, you've got the best possible noise figure, and you're boosting that signal before it gets power divided. That's the good news. Preamplifiers have a huge set of vulnerabilities. If there's a very loud, strong signal somewhere in the radio frequency spectrum, in other words, between the VHF television region of around 170 megacycles and UHF starting at 470 megs, if somewhere in between, at 160 megs, there's a real strong signal that comes into that preamplifier and saturates it, it gives you all kinds of grief. Preamplifiers are vulnerable to lightning strikes, they're vulnerable to strong local signals that are not being filtered out, so you get a bunch of pluses and a bunch of minuses, and you got to be kind of careful, and you got to do a little bit of further testing. And what Eric is showing us is that when there's a strong local signal, or if your preamplifier has been damaged, or if it's a poor design that has a high noise figure, lack of good sensitivity to the preamplifier, adding the preamplifier where you expect to get a benefit, in some cases you can get a loss. And so the noise that it adds is a function of noise figure. The noise it adds can be a function of intermodulation distortion. It is mixing multiple signals together because your antenna is listening DC to light. The preamplifier is looking at a very wide... Let me drop it. It's listening to a very wide frequency region with all kinds of strong and weak signals in there being mishmashed together. And as you approach the limiting characteristics, the upper end of the dynamic range of the preamplifier, all kinds of nasty things start happening. So I wish more preamplifier manufacturers would design a preamplifier that has a bypassing relay, so you have the ability to press the button in the house, which makes the preamplifier go into the bypass mode, so you can compare the results with and without the preamplifier. When it comes to military electronics, you need a low noise preamplifier. All the good ones have got that bypassing relay. Many of the pieces of space hardware, they're afraid to put in a preamplifier because of all the vulnerability it creates. And quite often, some very sophisticated pieces of space hardware, satellites and space probes, really have a mixer front end. So the noise that you experienced, I'll bet you if you look at the output of the preamplifier and a very, very broadband spectrum analyzer, I'll bet you there's some other very strong signals in there creating some grief, as well as even the preamplifier breaking into oscillation. When you get a chance to look at the output of the preamplifier with the spectrum analyzer, I think you're going to see a bunch of artifacts that you didn't expect to see, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
A2JIS.
JIS recognized, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
I think it would be very hard to rectify a person. well, you got to consider this, the trust that I did with the very different amplifiers, isn't it? Laboratory setting where there's only a single signal at various different levels to determine what the IP3 points and dynamic range of it. Most of them are rated as far as the actual ratings go, being able to deal with levels as high as plus 20 dBmV. Let's stick to the 75 ohm cable values. And once you start to go higher than that, you hit it too hard, and well, like a ringing oscillator. We've looked at the output of it, we've looked at the spectral purity, we've looked at the harmonics with any mixing products, and we've fed two signals that have a mathematical relationship to how they handle it. But because of the nature of the digital signal, any kind of resistance noise, you know, a pure resistor is a pure noise source. You don't amplify that. That's really a form of impulse noise. And that type of HVSB that we do, because, again, that's eight analog carriers, literally, if you want to think of it that way. And then, of course, we stuff it through a Nyquist filter, make like a line. Any kind of impulse that sees reduces the ability of the demodulator to demodulate. And that's why the decoded noise figure goes down. I've been in situations where you think the preamp is the most wonderful thing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Unfortunately, we lost a little bit of the bottom of that one.
the end of that one, Eric. Part of what's going on here, and Roger, we're going to get to you in a second. Hang in there. Digital over-the-air broadcast and digital television in general gives us a huge benefit. Very high definition in many cases. Beautiful snow-free pictures. Signal-to-noise ratio looks beautiful. And lots of extra channels. The 1/6 megacycle bandwidth of a channel can now have as many as 9 program channels really being squeezed in there when you combine both video and audio. That's the good news. But the digital television has got a number of vulnerabilities. Impulse noise, for instance, is one of the main reasons why I believe very few VHF digital television channels exist. Everybody's going to UHF because man-made noise, impulse noise, static from arcing power line resistor. And now, you were telling us, Eric, that the broadcast industry was in the process of making a decision, possibly by the end of this year, in which some design changes might take place that will make some improvements. Give us some words on this one, Eric. K2EJ, because you're in the thick of it in the broadcast industry for the last zillion years. K2IW and TechNet. You've got it, Eric.
Question?
We're going to get to you, Roger, and then question in that order. Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Nice. You're talking about ATSC-3. You're not going to see that for another 5 years, probably. This January, they're going to decide on the basic transport system and other elements of it. Also, the selection of the audio system in mind. That's a work in progress that's still going on. And that, by the way, is a different form of transmission, which will be CLFM, and it'll be more like a cell site kind of thing with a synchronous transmitter running. Let's skip that for the moment. Let's go to just plain old digital television. What's happening now is with the auction that's coming up, broadcasters have the option to sell their frequencies. So they're operating in UHF, and they're up near the 600 megahertz band, which they want to auction off. You now have the opportunity, or actually the opportunity to pass, where you can select a VHF channel. So, many of these UHF stations are now going to be migrating back down to VHF. So that includes low VHF, which is probably WK2J.
So it's a work in progress, and I think you're telling me that good news is coming, but it's going to be a couple of years before we actually see it. I want to mention to you, Eric, that there is a low-power AM television channel, channel number 17, WLIG-LP, which I've been watching from time to time. And a few days ago, the picture locked up, but the audio kept going for the next couple of days. In the last 2 days, the audio has also gone into a failure mode. So over-the-air broadcast, WLIG from Plainview. Are you familiar with that station, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
W2HRO.
Yes, I am, Dick. And actually, that was supposed to have gone away last year. there's a long story behind that one.
Okay. We've got Roger, question, and HRO in that order right now. Roger, K2JAS, giving us a nice signal from, was it, Morganville, New Jersey, way out there in the boonies. You got it, Roger. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, all. This is Roger, K2JAS, and several things. Number one, I just spent a couple of days putting up a 11-element Cushcraft beam at about 13 to 15 feet above the peak of my roof, and I can now rotate it. And I was wondering if anybody can hear me on the input, if I am a DFQ into the machine. I know the machine is DFQ to me. Back to you, Dick. That was part A.
Perfect. Reach that down, Dick.
Out here in Huntington, your beautiful DFQ on the input, Roger, for question number one. So I'm hearing you, let me see. If I look at QRZ.com, they're going to tell me that you and I are how many miles apart? 56. You and I are 60 miles apart. So I'm hearing you on the input from 60 miles away with a fairly yucky receiving antenna right now. Back to you, Roger.
Okay, K2JAS. Thank you for that. So everything is working. I'm feeding about 10 watts into a 171 amplifier. So that plus the 11 element beam dead nuts on your repeater, I should be able to get in pretty well. Thank you for that. Let me drop it 1 second. Okay, here's the second part. I have had an old Cushcraft R5 vertical antenna sitting on top of my Mosley TA-33, and that vertical antenna fell down. What is left up on the roof on that mast is the matching transformer and the four-wire ground plane. Okay, it's too much trouble to take down the beam and retrieve the old matching transformer. Let me drop it. Okay, so now the question is, I have it all disassembled. Let me back up a second. The matching transformer and the four-wire ground plane are still up on the roof, unreachable. The vertical section of the R5 is now in four or five pieces. It's all put into my airplane, and I'm flying it to Florida tomorrow. So now the question is, if I reassemble this thing, can I feed it without the matching transformer? Let me drop it. And from what I understand, the matching section, that box of matching transformer and ballon, is something on the order of 4.85 to 1. So this vertical antenna is supposedly N-fed. Let me drop it. And here's the question. What should the N-fed impedance of a half-wave antenna be like? Is it in the vicinity of 100 ohms? Or can I feed it with open wire line and use a Johnson matchbox? Back to you, Dick. K2JAS.
If I understand correctly, you've got a half wave long radiator, something that resonates in the half wave mode, not the quarter wave mode, and you're feeding the open end of that. That impedance out there of the open end, even though the center is around 73 ohms, the open end impedance is around 1,500 ohms. With the right kind of a L network that you could easily build, homebrew, and design it by way of the Berkeley program, you Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, and you answer the question, and they'll give you 15 designs of an impedance matching device. Some of them very simple, some of them more elaborate. So you can impedance match that feeding the end, but if it's a pure half-wave dipole, and you feed the open end, it's 1,500 ohms. It'll give you a fierce vizwar if you don't put an impedance matching device there. There's a huge advantage of feeding that open end. If this is a portable situation, like at a field day operation, and you shoot a wire into the air with a slingshot, and now this wire is a half wavelength long, and the end of it that comes down to the ground, you feed the open end of a half wave, 1,500 ohms, with the right kind of impedance matching device. One simple ground rod into the ground will give you the counterpoise. You don't have to lay down a zillion ground plane radials for that high-performance vertical antenna. So there's a lot going for feeding the open end. It is very unconventional, simply because people don't understand it. And some of the information I think you need, Roger. K2JIS, K2LAW in the DECnet.
Hey, K2JIS, thank you for that, Dick. I had no idea it was 1,500 ohms. I thought it was more like 100 or so. I was looking at there's a website where they show you how to rebuild this box, assuming something went wrong with the matching box. And the cover off of it looks like there are two toroids in that box. One is for impedance matching, and the second one is as a ballon. And since I am not really set up to wind toroids, I was thinking maybe I could feed this with an open wire line and a Johnson matchbox, but I think not. I think I'm just going to order a new box. Back to you, Dick. K2JAS.
Dick?
Right, Eric.
Yeah, the box that he's talking about, the input is at 41,000, which actually makes the one side of it to hook up to the manual that is essentially mounted on the antenna. The output of that is another toy. By the way, the both bipolar windings, not that many windings. If you were going to do it by hand, it would take you maybe about 20 minutes. You just have to have the right cord because it's very high permeability cord, but it's very broadband. There's also, I think in the R7, they actually use a capacitor to help cancel some of the reactants that they were dealing with. And it's a multi-band antenna, so that traps everywhere. Actually, some of the way that it functions is interesting, but you know, it's a doable thing if you want to make the mad floppy for it. But you know, no one buy it.
Yeah, turns didn't look all that difficult to make. Yes, you were right. The two bipolar torides, and then I. Just throw money at the problem and make it all go away. But I did want to understand what's going on there. And you're absolutely right, Dick. You don't need radio on this thing. That's nonetheless, I'm going to mount it on a fence that goes around the swimming pool.
Yeah, once you've got a dipole-like structure, halfway dipole-like structure, somewhere in the antenna, whether it's the driven element of a Yagi, whether it's a dipole all by itself, whether it's a vertical, there's nothing magic about feeding it in the center at 72 ohms. You can feed it anywhere along the length, but you're going to get different impedances, and you need some balancing, unless you're feeding it at the open end, and there it's around 1,500 ohms. So very few people do that. So there was a person now who said, question. We're going to pick up HRO after that, but the person who said question, what's your call letters and name? And go right ahead with your question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
W2LIW, it's the call name, Joe, and the question was on the comment about the TV stuff changing. What I wanted to know is, when that stuff changes, is the receiving equipment that is currently being used today going to be backwards compatible?
Yeah, that's for Eric. KE2EJ, tell us about ATS-3 and possible compatibility. Over to you, Eric.
Okay. The concept is, when we go to ATS-3, is that the broadcasters will get together in one local area, create one DGB, GPS-B transmitter, and everybody will go through the OFDM ATS-3 type transmitter. The reason for that is they're not compatible at all. One of the things that the ATS-3C3 do is handle higher data rates. You're talking about data rates that make it up to about 30 megabits, which will allow for the transmission of ultra HD, meaning that you'll be able to get a 4K picture over the air. With an 8-bit. Well, actually, it could do with 8-bit. You'll have the problem of sucking up more bandwidth without size of 6 megahertz range. So the concept of using the COFDM and some new compression techniques, we're essentially going to be able to get a 30 megabit stream at 6 megahertz, which is quite a feat, actually. KQRWK to the gang.
Give me your best guess, Eric. Is that likely to be decided? And if it is, I believe it's going to be reverse compatible with the current receivers, and how long must I hold my breath before I get this? When it comes to over-the-air broadcast and/or cable service, is this possible within the next, let's say, 3 years? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, as far as when Dick the old fart gets, it'll probably be after his death. It's my new thing. Oh, yeah, I had to say that. But here's the man who's still using a converter box. You can on cable right now. There are a number of cable systems that are offering a Ultra HD channel. I'm not sure if Cablevision has it, but there are some cable companies around the world and around the country that are currently offering a UHD channel one of them, which is, I think, one of us is providing the material. It's glowing because there are UAPs out there, and there is, and it's beginning to grow, the number of UHD sets and Ultra HD Blu-ray players. So content is slowly becoming available. Broadcasters have been actually switching to 4K cameras, the ones that have money that have been updating. And there's actually a lot of benefits in it. There's also edit room, especially if you're producing 1080i for 4K. You get a lot of latitude. You can spin. If your shot was too wide, you wanted it to be tight, you can zoom in, and it, you don't see the difference. So, actually, you can blow it up 4:1, and it's a perfect 1080i. RWK to the gang.
Good things are coming. Since I'm, by the way, I am using a solid-state television these days without a converter box. I have slightly updated. But when it comes to over-the-air broadcast of UHD, UHD, will its vulnerability with COFDM be a little bit better than we have with current vulnerability to co-channel interference, impulse noise, and whatever? What's your guess on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, COFDM, or rather ODFM, I'm not going to get into that now. Think of it as a thousand little carriers. You start to get a little distortion. What actually happens is the bitrate reduces and it doesn't just simply go away. The noise margins are a little better, but there's a cost to fall. If you want to create the same coverage area, that's why they're talking about doing it in a cellular format. I think it takes considerably a lot more energy to produce the same coverage area as it does with HVSB. But HVSB took about the same energy as analog to replicate its coverage range. Don't think of it, but actually the ETV transmitters that we have to operate at lower power levels than we.
Yes, I know that they're more efficient of the spectrum. They're running at lower power levels than the analog days, and we were promised that we would have the exact same range. Are we slowly admitting that the range has definitely decreased of over-the-air broadcast when we went from analog to digital TV? Have the broadcasters finally admitted that the range is approximately half what it used to be? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
No broadcaster in his right mind is going to come out and say that. Actually, it's the FCC who decided, how much DBC is going to be in a particular coverage area. So, had they done it right, the power level would be higher. Actually, at the beginning of the transition, once the analogs went away, you could file for an increase in power. I remember what the percentage was. I think it was something like 15% over what you were running while you were doing simulcast between that. All in all, if you look at the grade B lines, the digital actually makes it to where the grade B lines are. But try and get, as you approach it or as you get past it, you don't have the 20-foot antenna in the air on top of your house. You're flapping in the wind, so to speak. Depends upon who's asking the question and who's looking at the answer.
There was one last set of words I'm going to put in here. And Eric, I want you to either confirm or tell me I'm crazy. In the old days, we had a rotator on a television aerial so that we could listen to New York City and then rotate it up toward Connecticut to listen to those channels. So to peak the direction of arrival of the signal. With modern-day over-the-air broadcast digital television, because of its vulnerability to multipath, there's a great advantage of using a rotator on your television aerial if you're using over-the-air broadcast, because now you can do some fine-tuning with the direction of the antenna so that the nulls of that antenna pattern, every antenna has got some nulls in the pattern, you're able to tune them into the direction where the major multipath, the reflection off that water tower is coming from, and therefore the channel that would be blanked on you quite often can come back when you've got a rotator. I did notice that you were using a rotator, even though you've got a television aerial on your broadcast tower that's nice and high up, and you could make improvements in the bit error rate when you did that. So although not many people know this, if you're doing over-the-air broadcast, There's a significant advantage in using a television aerial rotator, even if you're just watching only New York City all the time. That's an opinion of mine. You're allowed to say you agree or disagree, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW, the tech man.
Go back 5 years, go back 7 years or 10 years, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Beginning, if you had, say, a third generation equalizer, you could point your antenna at Empire and pick up channel 2 and channel 4, what else is on that edge? There's a bunch of them, channel 2, channel 4, channel 9, well, 9 moved, but, and let's see what else is on there. A couple others, I forget. And if you wanted to pick up Fox, which was 30, Fox was 44, I think. Numbers are getting jumbled in my head. One antenna is mounted on the right side of the mooring mast, slightly higher than the other antenna, which is on the left side of the mooring mast. You had to move your antenna maybe like 1 degree south in order to get Fox, if you would learn. So, today, that's not true. Today, you can literally, with today's receivers, we're talking new receivers, you can swing your antenna maybe about 130 degrees around where you're supposed to be pointed, and you'll still get it. K2LAW, K2LAW.
My current TV set, Eric, is a 2014 Vizio. It might be a 2015. I bought it a couple months ago. I'd like to believe that Vizio gave me the latest equalizer. When I look at the amount of channels that get blanked on it versus my Radio Shack set-top converter, the new Vizio set is a little bit more vulnerable to multipath. I'd like to believe, as I said, it's got the latest equalizer. I know I need an antenna rotator. I know that when Joe, W2RYY, uses his antenna rotator today on a good converter box, he sees significant improvements. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
You said Vizio, right? With a V?
That's a big 10-4, good buddy. You got it, Eric.
Chances are you may still have a third generation equalizer today because there was a lot of contention between the satellites and the equalizers which were made the fifth and seventh generation equalizers made by Samsung actually, or rather LG company, which bought Zenith and they hold the patent rights. That's to say LG on it, it ain't fifth or seventh. Vizio is a Chinese company, and they like to do things. I would guarantee that you've got the latest and greatest in that box.
Yeah, this was a no decision, rapid buy. The price was right. It wasn't very expensive. I didn't do very much research. I just bought it. I got sick and tired of this huge copper ray tube set with its 150 pounds and a zillion cubic feet taking up my living room, which doesn't give me as much space to store all my electronics. I might very well not have the latest and the greatest equalizer. Sorry to keep you waiting so long, Roger. Let me be to HRO. I know you wanted to give us some comments and or questions. You got it, Roger. K2LAW in the TechNet.
This is K2JAS, not the other station. I did want to stop, break in here for a moment to wish you all a very good fall and winter. I will see you on the other side of Florida when I get back. Thank you for answering my questions and really appreciate the net. Over to the other gentleman. This is Roger K2JAS, and I'm going that away. Bye-bye, guys.
Yeah, Roger number one. There's some confusion here. WB2HRO is Roger number two. Roger number two, go right ahead.
It's Whiskey 2 Hotel. It's HRO today. First time I've listened to a co-worker of mine, John, KTQ, recommend tune in to it and listen. It's been interesting so far. Let me drop the repeater for a second.
By the way, I got.
I'm about 36 miles away from the roof. I'm about 10, 12 miles south of Princeton, New Jersey. My background, I'm an EE, 20 years in right, and bit about how that's done, and it was interesting to listen to the ATSE 3 just.